Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of health and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, and answers to your emails and your phone calls. You're on Ask Dr. Dawn, so please stay tuned and join me. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Lots of interesting stuff this week, but I don't know. I guess my sense of humor was tickled by this one. Basically, the Corn Refiners Association is seeking permission from the FDA to, well, let's use corporate speak, rebrand high fructose corn syrup as corn sugar, because, you know, high fructose corn syrup is bad, but corn sugar, well, that just sounds like ordinary sugar, right? And of course, in several recent press releases, the association has also pointed out that all sugars are alike, right? Corn sugar, just the same as table sugar, palm sugar. In fact, just the same as honey or fructose, right? Well, yeah, maybe not so much. Princeton's research team several years ago did a little experiment where they took rats and they gave them free access to water that was laced with either high fructose corn syrup or plain table sugar. And the rats, you know, could drink as much of the water as they wanted. And lo and behold, the rats that had access to the high fructose corn syrup put on more weight, even though their overall calorie intake was the same. Let me repeat that. The rats had the same number of calories, but the ones that got high fructose corn syrup put on more weight. Another problem with high fructose corn syrup, corn sugar, we might as well get used to using the new term because I have no doubt the FDA will approve this, is that in the process of manufacturing it, mercury gets into the syrup. And in fact, researchers have found that if you look at processed foods that contain high fructose corn syrup, you will find mercury, which is an industrial byproduct that is extremely toxic and has no known safe dose in the food. So all sugars created equal? Maybe not so much. Let me also share with you a really interesting study that was published, it was announced at the European Society of Cardiology Congress. This was a paper that was yet to be published, the paper by Daan Komhout and other colleagues from the Wageningen University in the Netherlands, looked at omega-3 fatty acid and heart disease and concluded that use of omega-3 fatty acid is useless in patients who've suffered an MI. It does not prevent a recurrence. Okay, so do you have any idea how many studies have been published in the last 20 years showing that nutritional substances don't work for X? And half the time, the X isn't actually something that anyone ever claimed, but when in fact it is, if you actually look at the methods of most of these studies, they are, as a rule, either woefully underpowered or they use an inadequate dose of the nutritional. In the case of this study, the dose of omega-3 fatty acids were 400 milligrams a day, and they used margarine as the vehicle. So they basically took trans fat and they spiked it with fish oil at a low dose, and they fed it to 4,800 patients who were between the ages of 60 and 80 who'd already had a heart attack. And after 40 months, there was no difference between the two groups in terms of second heart attacks. Okay, margarine spiked with fish oil at low doses does not prevent myocardial infarctions. I don't actually think anybody claimed that margarine, trans fat, spiked with fish oil was going to do anybody any good, but we've definitively proved that it doesn't. I could definitively prove that any drug out there doesn't work. All I would have to do is set up a study where I gave an inadequate dose of the drug. In other words, instead of giving, 4 million units of penicillin, I could give 4,000 units. That would work. Instead of giving, 500 milligrams of ciprofloxacin, a common antibiotic, I could give a milligram. In fact, I could give 50 milligrams. That's only 10% of the effective dose. And you know what? Wouldn't work. when they do these studies, they are half the time when you read the methods, it's a setup. And I don't know where the funding comes from. I don't know why the doses are inadequate. I don't know if we're trying to prove something doesn't work because we're afraid it does. I really just don't understand. And we're going to an anonymous caller. Where are you from, Anonymous?
We're here in Santa Cruz, and boyfriend shy, so I'm talking to, for him. He's got a hernia. He's had it for a couple months. It pops out occasionally. He's been being very tender with himself, and he's preparing himself for a possibility of surgery because he wants it taken care of. In the meantime, he doesn't want to get weak, and he's wondering if he can do a little surfing.
You mean a little stretching?
Stretching. He's been doing, but he wants to know. He doesn't want to get weak.
Okay. All right. So what kind of exercise can a person with a hernia, and are we talking about a groin hernia, an inguinal hernia?
It's in his groin.
Yes. Okay.
On the right side. And it pops out, and he pushes it back in. He's a carpenter.
Okay.
But his hobby is surfing and fishing.
Sure.
And he misses the water, so he's wanting to do the right thing.
Well, the main thing that you want to avoid in a circumstance when you have a hernia and you're waiting for surgery is increased intra-abdominal pressure, which means bearing down. So, for example, if you take a big deep breath because you're lifting a box, let's say, so you take a big deep breath and you hold the breath and you lift, that's going to pop your hernia out. Whereas if you are lifting and breathing out at the same time, you're less likely to pop the hernia out.
Okay.
In general, I would suggest doing work with the extremities. So, for example, if you want to keep your arms strong, don't be squatting and lifting or doing barbells, but do light weights and do one arm at a time so that you're not holding your breath and lifting and you're not moving your torso. But you're isolating that arm. Same thing for the legs. You can do isolated muscle exercises without holding your breath and bearing down, and you're not going to trigger the hernia popping out.
Okay.
He needs to avoid getting colds or flus. He should be really careful with hand washing because sneezing is a great way to pop the hernia out.
Okay.
And coughing and sneezing can often trigger an incarceration, which is where the hernia pops out and then isn't reducible. And that's an emergency surgery situation that he wants to avoid. As far as surfing's concerned, it's a little risky because if he gets out there and he does have an incarceration event, and, when you pop up onto a surfboard, there is a tendency to take a big deep breath and puff as you come up.
Okay, yeah.
And as you do that, if he does incarcerate, that's excruciatingly painful. He's going to be incapacitated out in the water. Not a good idea.
Okay.
The other thing, don't take three-day hikes into the wilderness. Don't go up where there's no cell phone access by yourself, because you get into trouble, you really will not be able to walk out of it.
Okay. So essentially, he's doing the right thing, which is preparing himself for surgery. If he wants his regular life, that's where he wants to go.
Afraid so, yes.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Jean in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jean. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Good, thank you. It's a little foggy, but that's all right. I wanted to ask a question. I've had hip bursitis since January of this year. And I've had several flare-ups, and at that time I've had two shots, one in February and one in July, of cortisone or steroids. And those worked for a while. And while I was on the last shot from July, my theory was if I could exercise and do physical therapy and do a mild form of yoga, that would kind of cure it. But it seems like, as I'm getting to know this, it's not a cure-all thing. Maybe it's a manageable thing. And so I'm wondering what advice you have for people that have hip bursitis. It seems like sometimes I'll do something like swimming or biking or stairs, not to an overuse, according to me, but then the hip bursitis will flare up.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the first advice that I have is that as we get older, we get tighter. And there's a band that goes from the knee to the hip called the iliotibial band. And it's kind of like if you've ever eaten a chicken thigh, or a drumstick, there's this kind of rubbery band of tissue that's attached to the muscle that some people chow down and some people, it's almost like a bone, but it's not.
Okay.
That's essentially the chicken's iliotibial band.
Uh-huh.
And it's in turkeys, they're really gnarly, and nobody eats those. But that is collagen, and it's kind of a collagen rope, and the muscles attach onto it because otherwise they wouldn't be able to do their thing pulling the leg around. So they need an attachment point in the middle of the bone that slides over the bone.
Okay.
And that big hip bone that we've all got sticking out, the greater trochanter, is wider apart than in women than in men, duh, right? Because women have to give birth.
Mm-hmm.
And our knees are closer together. So women's hips kind of move, their leg bones, their femurs move in at the knee and out at the hip. So that bone where it's got a big knob on it, the trochanter, is right up against this ropey bit of collagen, and it tends to snap over it. And as we get older and tighter, it snaps harder, and the bursa is there to act as a lubricant and keep the tendon, or let's call it the collagen rope because it's not strictly speaking a tendon, keep that from being eroded away by the bone, literally frayed.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But what instead happens is the bursa gets inflamed.
Right.
So I have to say, in all fairness, that I have some disappointment with the results that I get when I send patients to physical therapy.
Mm.
And I think some of it has to do with variation in personalities of the patients and their willingness to do follow-through.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly think some of it is the physical therapists themselves, and there are people who have more or less expertise or commitment or something, and I don't want to diss anybody out there,
mm-hmm.
but I do have to say that there's obviously an art to this, and it doesn't always work as well as I would like to see it work. If you are not doing some kind of specific stretch that really stretches that band from the hip to the knee, and you're not feeling that thing stretch every day with what you're doing, then I don't think you've gotten the right physical therapy for this problem.
Oh, okay.
And unfortunately, a lot of people don't seem to get the right physical therapy. This is a hard area to stretch, and I can't describe the stretch to you. I can send you, if you send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, either to my practice in Scotts Valley, my practice on Mission Street, or the station here, and all of those things are in the phone book.
Mm-hmm.
I'll Xerox it out of the book and send you a copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a good stretch for this iliotibial band, as it's called.
Is it the stretch, the band is on the side where the hip bursitis would be, or in the front?
On the side.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a tough area to stretch. It really does require some maneuvering. But if you keep in mind that you're trying to feel the stretch from the outside of the knee to the outside of the hip, above where that bursa is, then you'll maneuver around until you feel that stretch in that location. And that area needs to loosen up so that you're not snapping it over the bursa all the time when you exercise, which is how you're getting this started.
All right. Yeah, because I've been frustrated. It seems like everything else for me so far, I'm 60, has been able to be cured. This one is just
right.
Puzzle.
Yeah, and icing the area after activity.
Oh, okay.
One of the things I'll often do with people, if they have a tendency to inflame something, I'm like, okay, do the activity. Then as soon as you're done, ice it.
Mm-hmm.
And take some ibuprofen or some naproxen, unless you have a history of ulcers or bad kidneys or something where you wouldn't tolerate this drug. But
is that like Tylenol or Advil?
Like Advil or Aleve, Tylenol.
Oh, okay.
And Tylenol is acetaminophen, which is a great pain reliever, but does not have anti-inflammatory properties.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Okay.
And it's the anti-inflammation that we're looking for. My producer also says that he was just looking for stretching. So you could look at stretching the iliotibial band, and you'll probably, in a search engine, find something video-wise that might give you a hint. But I haven't reviewed these videos. You know, I'm just telling you they're out there. I don't know if they're any good. I'll go look at them later, and if I think they're not good, I'll retract that reference, okay?
Sure. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you, and have a great day.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Before I answer the emails, let me ask those of you who are in California to please call, write, email the governor and ask him to sign the healthcare bills that are on his desk. He's getting a ton of pressure from the insurance companies, which just got permission from the insurance commissioner to hike their rates. So just about everybody on October 1st is going to see a double-digit hike in their insurance rates. This is at a time when these rates are already at historical highs. The insurance commissioner is basically saying, hey, what can I do? It's legal for them to do this. Well, you know what? What we can do? We can make it illegal. In fact, we just did. It got through the legislature. It's on the governor's desk. Arnold, we could use some help here. Please, just send that message out. I really think that this is definitely a time when maybe, just maybe, the people might have a slight amount of leverage if they get up on their hind legs and use it. And I have just a list of bills that you might consider talking to the governor about, and just specific bills. Thank you to Charlie for this. Senate Bill 900 and Assembly Bill 1602 set up the health exchange. This one, folks, we really need. I am just dying for a health exchange so that self-employed individuals can get the same benefit that people who are in medium to large corporations can get in terms of bargaining power. SB 1088 extends dependent child care insurance to age 26. This will bring something that is in the national bill, but it'll make it happen sooner here. Assembly Bill 2345, which expands preventative care coverage. 1825 would make maternity care a basic benefit. Doesn't sound like such a bad idea. Can't sell health insurance without maternity benefit. AB 2244 would prohibit limitation of coverage because of pre-existing conditions. Yeah. How about that? Why don't we do that one? AB 1600 extends standard patient protections to all mental health issues. That one I have a little bit of a debate with, but we won't go into that here. AB 2042 proposes limiting health plans and insurers to just one rate hike a year. Okay. I don't think there's too many people that would argue with that. And then there's a rescission bill for requiring health plans and insurers to file health insurance rate information with the state and allow California to do rate reviews. Basically, there's a lot out there right now that is sitting on the governor's desk that would make life better, safer, and healthier for the majority of Californians. And it's not going to affect tax revenues. It's not going to make the state any more broke than it is, because basically we're a huge market. This is a game of chicken with the insurance companies. They are not going to walk away from this market. They can still make a profit in this market, although it may be a little smaller than the profits that they've been making, and like world's smallest violin on that one, folks. So, two emails. Matt in Raleigh, North Carolina, sent a really nice follow-up to last week's program. I was glad to hear you address red meat allergy, which I suffer from, because when I tell people about it, they seem to regard me as a bit crazy. But your advice on improving the intestinal barrier function may not help. This reaction is initially triggered by a protein found in tick saliva, which mimics a protein found in the blood of all mammals except for primates. I could easily believe this, as I had an infected tick bite immediately prior to developing the food sensitivity, and I'm also allergic to ticks. So Matt gives a reference to that, which I did review, and I'm going to tell you about it. I found some very, very interesting information here that I'd like to share with you. Basically, this person, Matt, had hives that would come out of the blue and would be extremely painful and burning. And he eventually figured out that ground beef and sausage did it more than a high quality piece of steak. But it was a volume related thing. Living in North Carolina, as he does, there are a fair amount of ticks. So he had the opportunity to have multiple tick bites in his life. What the researchers are coming up with is an idea that people can develop a sudden allergy to red meat that seems to be triggered by a tick bite within several months before the allergy appears. It turns out that when a tick bite causes a significant skin reaction, it triggers the production of an antibody to a sugar present on meat, including our own meat, that's called alpha-galactosidase. Alpha-galactosidase is a common enzyme, and it is found on the surface of muscle tissue. And when you eat muscle tissue, you consume it. If you have the antibody present in your intestinal tract, it would trigger the release of histamine. Now, this type of immunity is IgE. This is the one where the antibody, the IgE, is produced in plasma cells floating around in the blood, B cells, in other words, that are specialized to make antibodies of this type, it then circulates and is collected and displayed on the surface of phagocytic cells called mast cells. And mast cells are present throughout the skin surfaces of the body. So particularly the linings of the intestine, the linings of the lungs, the linings of the nose, and the surface of the skin. That's where the IgE manages to come in contact with the compound to which people are allergic and bind and cause the mast cell to release the histamine. It turns out that if you have blood type B or blood type AB, you have a chemical in your blood that is very similar to alpha-galactosidase on the red blood cells, so you do not have the ability to become allergic in this way. Your immune system, your self-tolerance mechanism kicks in and prevents this from occurring. O-positive people are more likely to develop this. So, you know that old eat to your blood type thing? It doesn't work. It's too broad. It's not specific enough. But there are some interactions going on between your own blood type and what you eat, which do give a certain validity to some of the concepts in some individuals. The problem is that the blood type doesn't narrowly enough define the individuals to make it particularly useful advice. Anyway, I thought that it was worth sharing with you the idea that a tick bite could trigger an autoimmune condition that would result in allergies to muscle meats. Another interesting email that we received this week was from George in Santa Cruz, and it was a very long email, so I'm going to abstract it for you here. And basically what happened to George was that he got stuck in the Medicare gap where he had had a flexible sigmoidoscopy a couple of years prior and therefore did not qualify for a colonoscopy because Medicare's rules only let you have that procedure, I think it's every 5 years, if I recall. You have to wait at least 5 years after your flexible sigmoidoscopy before you could have a colonoscopy under Medicare rules. Well, in his case, his flexible sigmoidoscopy probably missed a cancer that was above the level, in other words, closer to the appendix, upstream from where that flexible, shorter device could get. As a result, that polyp or precancer had a chance to turn into a cancer. And by the time he had his colonoscopy, he had a cancer which had actually penetrated the wall. But he was lucky, doesn't seem to have metastasized or spread beyond. And he's now getting frequent tests and has done very well. But his comment was that when you play the numbers like this, there are going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And whenever you have an arbitrary rule, like the Medicare rule of every 5 years, some individuals are going to have a cancer that shows up in that interval and gets missed. So I'm glad that you're doing well, George. I'm sorry that your number came up, so to speak, in the lottery of what's going to be paid for. But I do have to say that as this is to be discussed as one of the downsides of healthcare reform, right now, we have healthcare haves and healthcare have-nots. If you don't have insurance or you have a high deductible, you're a have-not. If you've got really good insurance, a percentage of this population that is shrinking daily, you've got, you know, access to all kinds of robotic surgeries and whatever else might be the latest and the greatest thing, whether you need it or not. And of course, it's always Monday morning quarterbacking to make a decision in the long term about whether someone should have had a test earlier or later. On the subject of the sigmoidoscopies versus the colonoscopies, I have a suggestion, and I'm promoting this, have been actively for years with my patients, and it goes like this. Get a colonoscopy once if you have a family history of polyps or you want to find out if you make them, and then every year do stool cards for blood in your stool. We know that colonoscopies miss 10% of cancers. We know that. That's an unavoidable consequence of human frailty and the fact that nobody's perfect. So if that's the case, statistically speaking, if you're going to wait 10 years before you do another colonoscopy, that 10% of the population is going to progress. So that 10% of the cancer population, I should say, is going to progress. Why not screen them? Why not screen everybody who has a colonoscopy with a cheap, inexpensive fecal occult blood test every year and chase the positives? So if you had a colonoscopy and you don't have hemorrhoids and you don't have any other reason to be bleeding and you show up 3 years out with blood, do another test. If there's still blood, well, cancers bleed. Let's do another colonoscopy on that person. I think we would find the cancers we missed on the first pass before they metastasized if we used that as our strategy. One more interesting news story. This is about selenium and bladder cancer. These are epidemiologic studies that were put together in a meta-analysis. And what they were looking at was the selenium level in the serum and the toenails. So not just what you ate yesterday, but what you'd had in the last 6 months. A very good way, I might add, to go about a nutritional study, because it eliminates that sort of variable of having eaten something the night before. So it reduces the noise. And what they found was that there was a significant protective effect for bladder cancer. And they looked at sex, toenail selenium, as I said, and smoking status. And what they found was in smokers and non-smokers, there seemed to be a good safety factor coming with higher levels, higher quartiles. The highest quartile of selenium had the lowest risk of bladder cancer. So selenium's had a checkered history. Too much selenium is very toxic, and not enough is not so good for you. There's a sweet spot of selenium. The numbers are pretty much known what a good selenium level is. Taking a supplement that contains, say, 200 to 300 micrograms of selenium, good idea. Taking more than 800 micrograms of selenium a day, bad idea. That might get you toxic over time. So for people who are taking multiple vitamins, perhaps you're taking a multivitamin and you're doing a protein shake, and you might be doing some sort of immune stimulant agent, you need to sit down and add up all of the micrograms in selenium in all of the products you're consuming to be sure you're not going above that 800 number. That's a solid safety factor. And in fact, it's one of the nutritional substances that it's actually not hard to be taking too much of if you take a lot of supplements. And I have, in doing my supplement analyses on some of my nutrition patients, found, in fact, people who were getting too much. It takes a lot of work to get too much vitamin D, which is the other one that toxicity is at least a rational issue. Many of the other vitamins, pretty hard. Vitamin A accumulates in the liver. The problem with vitamin A is if you take it in the non-beta carotene form, it can cause birth defects. So keeping the levels below, say, 24,000 units a day, really good idea if you might get pregnant. Let's go to Lucia in Hollister. Hello, Lucia.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thank you for taking my call. I had phoned you about this problem before for a different question. I have osteopenia, and I was taking Fosamax and developed some esophageal problems, and so my doctor told me to stop taking it. And she sent me for an endoscopy and a colonoscopy. Uh-huh. The endoscopy went fine, but then when they started doing the colonoscopy, I apparently fainted, and I have since then been classified. I mean, I already knew that I have a history of fainting spells, but I fainted, so they didn't stop. I went to see cardiologist and everything, but we thought it was my heart. But anyway, my question is, because they didn't find anything either with the endoscopy or the partial colonoscopy, whether I should go through with a full colonoscopy, because he said that I would have to go under general anesthesia to have the colonoscopy again.
Okay,
because
so
of this vasovagal.
Right. Vasovagal. I was going to tell you that that's what I thought you probably had.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a reflex that is sort of a bad reflex, where when you distend the colon, when they stretch it out with the air, it triggers a drop in the blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And a slowing of the heart rate, which is a bad combination. When your blood pressure drops, you'd like your heart rate to speed up rather than slow down. So you lose your ability to get blood to the brain and you pass out.
Right.
Right. People who are old enough to need colonoscopies are also old enough to have heart disease, so we get very nervous about inducing vasovagal reactions.
Mm-hmm.
people.
Yeah, they did. Excuse me for interrupting you.
Yeah.
Because my mother had
mitral valve prolapse.
Thank you. I can say I was examined for that as well, and it's negative.
Okay.
And so they said that it's just.
All right. So let me just kind of back up a little bit. You went to a gastroenterologist because you had upper GI symptoms. The gastroenterologist looked in your esophagus and stomach, and did he or she find any pathology, any gastritis?
No.
Or okay. Yes. So then the next thing that happens is because it's a gastroenterologist and because we're in the United States, they have to look in your colon and do a colonoscopy. And it doesn't matter whether the problem is a bleeding ulcer that's obvious. They still feel obligated to do colonoscopy. And the reason for that is, quite honestly, if you show up with colon cancer in 5 years, then they could be sued for not having done the colonoscopy, even though the reason you went to see them was an ulcer. It's crazy. We won't go into a discussion about the craziness because we'd never stop when we talk about medical legal covering your butt kind of behaviors that we see in this country. But that's pretty much what it is. If you're over 50, yes, you could make the argument that you need a colonoscopy. But you could also, at this point, having had a partial colonoscopy, do one of two other things rather than going under general anesthesia for a screening procedure, which I think is just nuts. You could have a virtual colonoscopy, which is a kind of a CT scan with contrast that is just as accurate, which is to say it misses 10% of cancers too, as a regular colonoscopy, and look at that upper part of the colon just to be sure. Mm-hmm. Or you could have a air contrast barium enema, which will also look at the upper part of the colon quite adequately. From the statistical standpoint, an air contrast barium enema with a lower flexible sigmoidoscopy will find just as many cancers as a colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did have the barium enema.
Well,
I fainted.
Well, that's because you faint when your colon is distended.
Yeah.
But you're done. You don't need to go any further. It sounds to me like you've done your screening.
No, she stopped, though, because when I started, faint all the way. I felt the symptoms, and I said, I'm going to faint, I'm going to faint. So she said, okay, I'm going to stop. So she stopped.
And she stopped putting the air in your colon?
Yeah, she pulled the scope and everything.
No, honey, the barium enema.
I mean, not a scope, but the hose that they blow the air with. And
okay, yes, so she stopped putting the air in because you get faint when your colon is distended. Okay,
yeah.
So have a virtual colonoscopy.
Okay. Isn't that one of the ones that you've talked about before that are very high risk for cancer?
No, it's not very high risk for cancer. It's a radiation hit, but mm-hmm. you're going to get 7 months of background radiation once by doing this. And you're going to find out if you have colon cancer, and you probably don't. Or you could just forget the whole thing and do stool cards for blood every year. And if you get a series of positives, then you're going to have to bite the bullet and do the virtual colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
But you're going to have to make the decision because no doctor is going to go on record as telling you you don't need this because mm-hmm. they could be sued when you get cancer 5 years from now. So they're not going to go on record. They're not going to stick their neck on the chopping block. You have to refuse. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. You can take responsibility for your own self. This
right,
is not a
right.
big risk here.
Yeah. The cardiologist thought that I probably don't have anything to worry about. Because he said that usually when there's a problem, it's caught through the endoscopy or the sigmoidoscopy. And that's when they do the full colonoscopy, when they find problems in the lower...
Well, your cardiologist is about, 6 to 10 years out of date in terms of how medicine is currently being practiced. But hey, he's a cardiologist, so...
Yeah, right.
I'm not sure what you're asking me.
Mm-hmm.
Are you asking me, do I need to do anything else?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you had part of your colon looked at, and it was fine.
No problem.
And you didn't have any positive stool cards. The only reason they were looking in your colon was because you're over 50.
Mm-hmm.
And you were in a gastroenterologist's office. Okay. So pretend that you never went to the gastroenterologist's office. Would you have had a colonoscopy?
No.
Okay. So you're done. You're done. You're done. They're off the hook. Just refuse to do anything further and do stool cards every year. And like I said, if the stool cards are coming up positive, you have to chase the positives.
Mm-hmm.
but not at the risk of your health. And certainly, you know,
right.
passing out is not a good thing.
Right.
I mean, they could pump you full of fluid and put you flat and basically let you pass out mm-hmm. and just make sure that they open up the IV fluid and, you know, you'd be doing it in a surgery center, but I don't think they necessarily have to put you under. I don't think that'll stop you from having a vasovagal attack. Anyway,
yeah.
It's a reflex. It's not a psychological problem.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much. Oh, and I wanted to thank you for something else that you said on the air one time about how to determine whether your calcium is good or not. I was taking one of the most popular brand names.
Uh-huh.
And within the first 15 minutes, most of it dissolved in, you know, in vinegar.
The vinegar test,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but then it took about almost an hour for the whole thing to completely dissolve. So I said, oh, so this isn't a good one.
Yeah, so, might be better to find one that dissolves a little faster.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So thank you for that.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
This one, rather spooky, recent study looking at ADHD, hyperactivity disorder, and showing that there's a strong correlation with pesticide in the mother's urine. So if you measure organophosphate pesticides in the pregnant woman's urine, for each tenfold increase in pesticide metabolites, and these are things like malathione and other pesticides that are used widely in California on fruits and vegetables, you find a fivefold increase in the rates of ADHD by the time a child is five. And this study was done in the Salinas Valley. So the average rates in that cohort were greater. So it's a good place to do a study like this because you can take a look at a range of values that might not otherwise be seen in a large enough number of people. Upshot of this is pregnant women and women who are planning pregnancy should be sure that they wash fruits and vegetables carefully. They should try to eat organic fruits and vegetables where that is possible, but they should certainly be very, very good about trying to clean the skins off. Even peeling or washing carefully removes a lot of the pesticides. The most important lesson here is that these pesticide levels in the pregnant women were still within acceptable ranges from the EPA. These were not people who were toxic. These were generally assumed to be safe levels. These are levels that would not get you pulled off the work site, that would be within the normal range. But yet there was a very strong correlation in the development of ADHD. And we have seen a huge surge of children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in our culture for the last 20 years. The rates have been just going up and going up and going up. Possibly this is a factor. Now, don't stop eating fruits and vegetables. That's not the answer. But washing them, definitely a good idea. A Stanford study was recently published that looked at some common diseases and applied the same logic that we apply to sickle cell anemia. Most of you have probably heard this story, that sickle cell anemia is a disease that is fairly common in African Americans, and very common in Africans for that matter. What happens in this disease is that it's a recessive, so you need to get a gene from both parents for this to get really, really sick. But people who only get one copy of the gene rather than two copies have blood that's a little bit different. They mostly don't get sickle cell crises, but they have what's called sickle cell trait. And people with sickle cell trait are very, very protected against malaria, which is quite common throughout Africa. And if you're a pregnant woman and you get malaria, you're likely to die. So there's a strong selective evolutionary bias towards being protected against malaria. Having one copy of this gene protects you. Having two copies probably kills you in childhood. And having no copies means that you're more vulnerable to malaria and more likely to be killed while pregnant because of the omnipresence of malaria in Africa. Well, the same sort of logic applies to a number of other diseases. This study out of Stanford by Dr. Atul Butte and graduate student Eric Corona looked at a number of things, and I was surprised to learn that type 1 diabetes is associated with If you have that DNA, you're much more able to protect yourself against enterovirus, which is a type of bacterial infection. And if you have rheumatoid arthritis DNA, you're much more likely to be able to protect yourself against tuberculosis. So many of these diseases have to be considered diseases in context, but having the DNA or a portion of the DNA, just one copy in the case of sickle cell, or I presume that in the case of rheumatoid arthritis, actually, since that's not a classic recessive issue, that even one copy is, well, you live long enough to reproduce and avoid tuberculosis, and then you get your rheumatoid arthritis. So an interesting way of thinking about these diseases is that there may be some reason that they persist in the gene pool. It makes a lot of sense to go hunting for that. Let's talk to Amy in Capitola. Hello, Amy, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. I have a question. My 20-year-old son has just been diagnosed with MRSA, and this is his second round. He had it in February of last year, and he's taking sulfamef and rifampin, 300 milligrams. Is he supposed to be doing something with the nose spray? I know there's something with the nose, with the secretions in the nose.
Right, right. Now, you said this was his third infection?
Second
infection. Okay.
And it seems to be responding to these meds.
Oh, yeah. Community-acquired MRSA is a different animal than hospital-acquired MRSA, by the way. And the hospital ones are much nastier. But the community ones are no slouch, but they are not as resistant to the old antibiotics, so we can generally get them. And rifampin is turning out to have a renaissance. It was an old drug only used for tuberculosis, and not that much even then. And then suddenly when MRSA came back, it's like, oh my God, rifampin works. We can dust that one off. And it's, you know, an old agent, but it's nice that we didn't throw away the blueprint for it. Anyway, nasal carriage is very controversial in terms of should you seek to eradicate nasal carriage. I'm old school. I did an infectious disease rotation 20 years ago in the early days of MRSA, and I was taught then, yes, you'd seek to eliminate nasal carriage. It'll hang out in the nose, not causing an infection, but then it gets under your fingernails and you get a bug bite and you scratch it and off we go again with another MRSA infection.
Mm-hmm.
So clinically, when I see recurrent infections, I always seek to eliminate nasal carriage by using mucoprosin, which is Bactroban, is the trade name, ointment in the nose.
And you can buy that over the counter?
No, you can't.
Okay.
That's an actual prescription. It's not super expensive. It is available as a generic now. You know, the question is, well, how long do you have to treat? I generally treat for 30 days. Do you also need to treat the rectum? And in general, I don't tell people to treat the rectum, but that's controversial. And there's no right answer to this because this is a relatively new phenomenon. And quite honestly, it's still an evolving problem that we're trying to get a handle on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so he should get the Bactroban.
In my opinion, if he's had two infections, that represents the potential that he is actually now his own little Typhoid Mary.
Okay.
And so why not try to get rid of that? It's a benign agent. It's, you know, doesn't cause a rash, doesn't cause adverse reactions by putting it in the nose. Probably non-FDA approved use of the ointment, which
I am required by law to disclose when I make a recommendation that is non-FDA or off-label.
So it's probably off-label. And so what?
Okay. And now also, I've heard he should be taking probiotics as well.
Well, anybody who's taking a couple of antibiotics is probably wreaking havoc with their intestinal flora. So, yes, I usually recommend using probiotics.
Okay.
The other people who share the household need to be careful that they don't use his towel, his bath sponge. Generally, the toilet seat's not so much of an issue, but towels definitely in households do seem to be a vector.
Okay, yeah, no one's doing that. Okay, and he's taking Gyrodophilus, which is 3.4 billion per capsule. Does that sound...
That sounds reasonable. That one just has Acidophilus in it, and there are several different subgroups, and I like the ones that have at least four or five different versions of Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus.
Okay. Is there anything you can recommend for that?
There are so many. I generally don't like to go brand names, but I say read the label and look for a dose of, say, 12 to 25 billion organisms, at least four varieties, two bifidos and two lactos, and you're probably good.
Bifidos and lactos. Okay, thank you so much. so much. I so appreciate your show.
You're
Take
welcome.
Care.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call. And Amy's call made me decide to pull this article out. This was clipped by my lovely clipping service, Joe Tribulato by name. Thank you, Joe. Contagious superbugs pop up in U.S. and Canada. Remember last year when we talked about the people going to India for their surgeries because it was so much cheaper to go to India or Pakistan? Well, it turns out they did more than save money. They've brought back very, very antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which all occurred in people who received medical care in India. The British Medical Journal published an article last month about that, describing dozens of cases in Britain. The superbugs contain a gene called NDM1, and it's named for New Delhi. I'm sure the New Delhi people love that. But realistically, this is a new plasmid, which is to say it's a little self-replicating piece of DNA that can be transmitted from bacterium to bacterium across species by a phenomenon known as bacterial conjugation. So this is a phenomenon that we have known occurs, and several disease-resistant genes spread between E. coli to other organisms such as Shigella, which is closely related to E. coli by this means. Now we have, well, basically a virtual superplasmid that's going to confer resistance to a great number of antibiotics. I don't know the specific mechanism of the resistance, but this is a big problem. And it's loose, has been reported in California, Massachusetts, and Illinois. And it can get into the bacterial genomes by at least three different documented mechanisms. So this is the MRSA of the next decade, and I will be sure to keep an eye out and monitor and keep you posted and keep my eyes open, too, for the first cases to cross our community. Let's go to Carol in Capitola.
Good on. My son is 22, and he's an athlete. He was just diagnosed with Kienbock disease, which is a bone disease that cuts off the circulation to the bone.
Can you spell that for me?
It's Kienbocks, the man named Kienbock that discovered it in 1910.
Right. Well,
and, it's in his wrist.
That's really dredging up. I don't know very much about this. It's a type of avascular necrosis.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's only in the wrist. Does he have it in other bones? Or I thought this was,
well,
was just something people got in their wrist.
It's the most symptomatic, apparently, affects the one little capitate bone in the wrist area there in the ulna. And what they do is, what they just discovered is that his two bones, the humerus and the ulna and the arm, are two different lengths instead of being even.
You mean the radius and the ulna?
I mean the radius,
yes,
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
So what they usually do is, orthopedically, is cut the bone, but they're not sure in his case that's what they're going to do, or, you know. Anyway, this was just one diagnosis.
Lunate bone already collapsed? I mean, has the bone...
It's on its way.
Okay.
Pretty progressive, she said. Yeah. Okay. Didn't know if any other means. The only thing you can find is, you know, surgery and orthopedic stuff on it. I didn't know really how else to approach it.
Well, the first thought I have is he needs to protect his other wrist.
Right.
Because this is kind of a vulnerability of the bone. And it's just subject, because of its anatomy, presumably, to lose its blood supply with pounding and forceful work. It's highly associated with mechanical labor. So,
he's a surfer.
So protecting the other wrist
is
going to be a really important piece of how he manages this. What kind of work does he do besides surfing?
Well, that is his work. He's actually a pro surfer, so he's out constantly surfing. That's his job, yeah.
Okay, nice work if you can get it. Yeah. Most people pay money to do that on the weekends, so that's cool.
Yeah.
it's nice work. It will, I think, be a problem for him if he has to have that wrist fused. I'm not sure how that would affect his surfing, but I presume that if he loses some of the flexibility of the wrist, that's going to impair his abilities. I hope he has a day job lined up for after he can't surf anymore.
that's the next step, I suppose.
But well,
I didn't know if you knew how progressive it usually is or if you knew much about it. I know, you know, it's not really so much a nutrition thing, but...
Yeah, once the bone loses its blood supply, it dies. And then you have, instead of a bone, which is the dynamic tissue that's going to keep rebuilding itself, you have a rock, which is going to break down into powder with repeated force. So he's going to lose one of his wrist bones. And, you know, the success of restoring the blood supply is not very good. So he might get lucky, but prognosis is not great for full wrist flexibility. I definitely don't know a lot about orthopedic surgery in this situation for how well they can preserve the hinge function of the wrist. But like I said, the other wrist is at risk, especially since surfing is kind of a two-handed thing.
Right.
And, you know, like I said, it's time to take the money he's making and invest it and think about what his post-surfing career is going to look like, because he's going to need a post-surfing career. I'm sorry to say it, but I really think that's true.
Yeah.
So okay, I hope you can advise him, and I wish I had better news for you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Goodbye.
We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. And I hope you'll listen next week for more Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.